friend here is Dorothy Spoon, and we were hiking partners in the Cascades and the Olympics for about a 10-year period back in the 30s and early 40s. And on the very first trip that we did together, we came through this valley. It was the tag end of a 180-mile backpack trip that we set up. And this was about the third or fourth to the last day of going through here. Now this program has been taped before. There are two tapes in the library, and maybe some of you have already heard it. So we want to keep it fairly flexible so you can ask the questions that you want to know. And we also will try to cover some of the things that we know you're going to ask. And so, Dorothy, do you want to lead off here?
Well, I'd like to share one of my favorite parts of the story of how we became friends in the first place, how we met. I first met Dorothy in 1934 on a college mountain climb, a climb of Mount Baker. I'd never met her before. And she was talking that weekend about a trip she had made the year before around Mount Rainier alone because she couldn't find a hiking partner. So I practically said, "Hey, I'll go." That sounded great fun to me. And 2 or 3 weeks later, we started out on a three-week trip together, not knowing each other. A friend said, "Oh, you have to have a third person. You can't go just two gals out into the wilderness alone." Well, we didn't know a third person. And their reasoning on it was not so much safety as they said, "You'll be so mad at each other before you're through that you won't be speaking. You won't have anything to do with each other after 3 weeks together." And here we are 50-some years later, still friends. And I don't have many friends that go that far back that I'm still in contact with.
Actually, it's 51 years since we met, because it was 1934, and 3 weeks later we started out on this particular trip. As Dorothy said, I had done a solo trip on the Wonderland Trail around Mount Rainier the summer before, and from that I thought I really wanted to get into the North Cascade Primitive area. So we put a map up here, and I know that it's too small, it's a regular highway map, but just so you'll see the area, the part, this is the state of Washington. What we wanted to get into is called the Primitive Area, and now it is the North Cascades National Park, the main part of it up here, which extends down almost to Lake Chelan. Actually, I think this is the, what do they call that? Can't read the fine print, Lake. Well, it's a national park down to here, and then I guess it's a recreation area. Yeah, a national recreation area around the head of the lake.
Mm-hmm. North Cascades National Park. This is
the yes. Park. Mm-hmm. Well, we started from Bellingham, Washington, and Mount Baker is right here. This is where we met, from Mount Baker. And when we did our climb, we had a ride as far as roads went up to Roos Creek, north of Mount Baker, and then we crossed just south of the Canadian boundary here, going over Hannigan Pass and picking up the Chilliwack stream, which drains into Lake Chilliwack in Canada, and then up over Whatcom Pass, which put us across the divide, and we went down the Little Beaver to the Skagit River. Now, on this map, what used to be the Skagit River is Ross Lake, but we were there when it was still the river. And then we came down this river to Diablo Dam and the Reflector Bar. There was a ranger station there, and that was where we picked up our second week's food supply. And because we mailed we divided our food into three packages, one that we took with us, one to be picked up here, and the other to be picked up at Stehekin from the ranger stations. And then we backtracked and went over what is now the North Cascade Highway. But at that time, it wasn't even thought of to be a highway. In fact, the trail that we were on was on the north side of Ruby Creek, and the road, the present road, is on the south side of Ruby Creek. But it does go up the granite, and then the highway swings off over to Washington Pass and comes on over into eastern Washington. But Rainy Pass is where it makes its swing east, and we headed southwest towards Lake Chelan. And we went down then to Bridge Creek and on down to Lake Chelan, and then of course took the boat across to Lucerne and came on up the road up Railroad Creek and continued on eventually across Cloudy Pass and Suattle Pass, down the Suattle River, coming out at, well, the Suattle Guard Station was the first place where we hit a road, and we did get a ride there, and got back to Bellingham all too much too soon. Now, very briefly, you see where we were then in that, but at that time it was called a primitive area and had been left quite primitive. We had to go to the Mount Baker National Forest supervisor, Mr. Pagger, for fire permits, and I outlined the trip to him that I had in mind, and he said, "Oh no, no, that area is undeveloped, and the only trail that fire trail that's been through there has not been maintained for the last 4 years, and there has been a silver thaw and a blowdown, and it's under logs and overgrown brush." And the more he talked, the more he sold us on the trip. And in those days, I don't think they'd been confronted with this kind of a situation before. I don't think they had a policy set up like they would have now where they'd say, "No, we're not going. That's a closed area," you see. But he didn't. He just kept trying to persuade us, and he was just talking us into it. And
there were a few times in the days following that where we weren't so sure, but what, he was right and we weren't.
What time of summer, what time of year did you go?
This was in late July and August. I can tell you exactly. I brought the, last year I found the diary. We kept diaries on all our trips. In fact, I still keep diaries on all. Instead of traveling with a backpack, I now travel with a suitcase and airplanes. But I still keep diaries. And there are 44 pages in this. Of course, we didn't have a typewriter along. It was it was a little written notebook, but my daughter-in-law retyped it for me. And we're not going to read all of this tonight. But I just thought I might pick out a date here to know exactly. I'm quite sure we were over here on the 7th of August.
So you figure about, back. About the 8th, so that would be about right.
Yeah, I think that was when it was.
7th or 8th.
Around the 7th or 8th of August that we got to this valley. But we had been hiking for 2 weeks before that, you see. So we were hiking in the last week of July. What else? Mm-hmm. We were starting.
Maybe we should skip part of that and tell them about this valley first and then go back and pick up whatever they want to hear about.
Which would what you would you rather we did that?
Mm-hmm. What it was like from Stehekin up?
Yes.
There was the Lady of the Lake in those days too, but it wasn't number two, it was one of the little ones. I don't think it was even the number one that's out there now. I'm not sure that was the one we were on. From Stehekin to Lucerne. And at that time, there was a resort area there. It was several buildings, cabins, a restaurant.
They called it Gettysburg because Oscar Getty was the one who operated it.
It was really a nice resort and popular. People came from Seattle, they'd come up on the boat. In fact, there were a number of resorts on the lake at that time,
yes.
small ones. Mm-hmm. And we stayed overnight there. had dinner in the restaurant, and after dehydrated food, that was a real treat to have fried chicken and pie, was it?
Yes, I think it was either blackberry or blueberry pie.
And then the next day, we were set to hike up the road coming up here. And all sorts of objections. You can't walk that far, seemed to be the general opinion. You shouldn't walk that far.
These were the guests, the guests at Gettysburg were giving all the advice.
And the people who ran, the local people who ran the place were saying, if you'll just wait, you can ride the truck back up. And you don't need to walk it because the truck will be coming down to get supplies or mail, and you can ride back up with the truck driver to the mine, 12 miles back up to the mine. Mm-hmm. Why don't you take it from there?
Well, we hadn't set out to walk or to ride in a truck, you know. And the one question we asked was, well, what time does the truck get down here? And they said, oh, about 1 o'clock. And we thought, well, we'd do our own thing. And they got into such an argument that they were kind of getting mad at each other, because some of the people thought that we should go ahead and hike, and some of them thought we should wait for the truck. And so they were arguing among themselves. And so Dorothy and I slipped out and headed for the campgrounds to roll out our sleeping. Well, I guess we'd already parked our stuff out there. And then we were intercepted by the housekeeper for the resort. And she said, no, you're not going to sleep out in the woods tonight. You're going to have a shower. I guess there was a reason for her suggesting that. And you're going to sleep between clean sheets tonight. And so we first objected, and then the shower was what really tempted. We decided we would like to do that, so we did. And the next morning we got up and left real early and headed up the road. And the switchbacks were there. That road, when I came back up, the next time was in 1968, and it seemed like the same road. I'm sure they have widened it and perhaps removed some curves and things, because I could kind of see on the side of the road where an old road has been scooped. But we met the truck about Nine Mile Creek. I think I told you Six Mile Creek the other day, but I was checking the diary again, and it was 9 miles. And the road came up exactly where it comes, as far as 10 Mile. And at 10 Mile, you'll notice that the valley is kind of flat there, and the creek is about the same level as the road. And that's where the road crossed, at 10 Mile. And it went up on the other side. And if any of you stand up there by the dining hall and look over the way, you will notice that the trees above a certain line that sort of slopes down like that are older trees. And the trees below that line are younger trees. You can just tell the line of where that road used to be. And that went right up to the present portal of the mine. It actually went, we were surprised to find that it went further than that when we left the mine, because it continued on and came down pretty much where it does now to the river. I think actually the crossing was a little further up, closer to the ballpark. There's a point out there where the fellows like to fish sometime with a big rock, and I think someone told me that was where the original crossing was. At any rate, we thought we'd be on a trail from the time we left the mine, but we discovered we were still on the road until we got down to the river, and then after we crossed the river, we were on trail, and continued on the trail up.
And of course, there was nothing in this area. We didn't even see this area because we were on the other side, but there were no buildings here at that time. They were up at the mine, what was there. In fact, the other day in the pictures of the history of the mine that Greg showed, there was one picture I recognized. 1936, I think, was the date on it. The mine entrance and a big square kind of a building off to the side of it. That was what it was like at that time, in 34.
Mm-hmm. I didn't catch, the road across River Prince, about down by 10 Mile.
Yes. In other words, the road goes underneath the tailings now. I mean, where the original road was is underneath the tailings. And in 68 or 69, I backtracked it down to where it disappeared under the tailings. And I think it's a shame that they don't have a trail on that old road, because it is a historic thing. And it would make a nice loop hike for people who can't take a long one. You could go up to the mine and then take that road down to the bridge at Copper Creek, or to the bridge across Copper Creek, and come on back on the tailings, you know, into the village. It'd be a nice loop. Right now, it's pretty well grown up, but you go through there and you can see it was a roadbed at one time. When we got to the mine, as Dorothy says, this one building was there, a nice new building. And a number of people, the man in charge, was very courteous and showed us around. And you know, I just might want to read that part of, I was just thinking that, if I can find that quick enough here.
By that time it was Howe Sound. But they were not mining, they were simply putting the tunnel in and working the claim so that they have to do a certain amount of improving, or at least pretend to work on it in order to hold the claim. And so they did have a small crew in who were doing that.
Where were the miners living, the staff living?
Honeymoon Heights. Well, you see, they were mining above before. The earlier mines were up above. This was the last portal, and it would make sense they actually came down to go to Honeymoon Heights.
But these were really just exploratory mines.
And the earlier mining, they would get that in the history that what's his name?
Nigel Adams.
Yeah, I think he has written the history there. I'll have to tell him about this one mistake, though, because it permeates all of what you hear about Holden. It's repeated even in the portal. I will have to talk to Rudy about that. The road was built in 1934. It was not built in 1937. I think where the confusion came in was this village was probably started about 1936, 37. And they probably connected up the 10 Mile, where it crossed 10 Mile to go up to the mine, connected that up with where it hits across the river down here. So if that's all they remember of the road, that probably was 1936 or 37. See, they'd have a purpose for it if there was a village here, but they didn't have a purpose for it on this side in 1934, because they were only about 1,000 feet in.
They would need it in order to build the village.
Yes.
They'd have to put the road
that's
in to bring
right.
in the things to build
yeah.
with.
I'll have to read his book sometime. One time when he spoke here, I didn't embarrass him before the group, but after the meeting, I got him off the side and said, but I walked that road in 1934, and he said, you walked a trail, and I said, I walked a road. He said, you didn't walk a road that a truck would drive on, and I said, we met the truck. And the people down at the Lucerne all told us the truck would be down there, and they tried to talk us into riding in it. Well, he said, that truck wasn't a big enough one to haul ties or a mine car or anything in. And I said, the mine car and the railroad ties were already in when we got there. No. Well, I realized what had happened. He had that part of his book already written. But I noticed that each year thereafter when he came here, if I was sitting in the audience, he'd always look a little nervous. Anyway, I think he can be forgiven for writing that, because probably the stretch from 10 Mile up to the present bridge crossing up there was probably finished about that time. I was going to read this little bit here. We reached the mine at 11 minutes after 10 in the morning. We would now have time to explore the mine, if it were permitted. A large building near the mine portal seemed to be the office and hub of activity. The miners were very courteous. One of the men obligingly conducted us through it. We were given miners' coats and hard hats to wear to protect us from rock fall, dripping water, and the cold. Then we were taken into the level where they were drilling a new tunnel. We climbed into an ore car, see, I knew they were there, which slowly slid down the tracks into the tunnel. The first plunge into darkness and coldness was, brought goose pimples. We looked at the ceiling, solid rock. We silently prayed there would be no earthquakes for a while, and then we mentally went ahead. As some switching of cars was necessary, we climbed out and proceeded the rest of the way on foot, jumping water puddles and lengthening our stride to make the ties. At the end of the tunnel, we watched the mucking machine in action, a rather complicated affair which was supposed to scoop up the muck and load it into the cars. When in action, we thought it resembled a rather ferocious monster suffering an attack of ague. We were ushered into a small room which opened off the left side of the tunnel. Three or four miners were having a luncheon break, and we were handed sack lunches and invited to enjoy them. And the foreman explained the operation to us. And then after we had gotten a little orientation in there of what they were doing, and they were only in about 1,000 feet at that time, crawled back into these cars and were taken back out of the mine itself. By 12:10, we were on the trail again. Now, this is where we think now we made a big mistake in hurrying through the valley as fast as we did. We had the miners tell us that we should be staying overnight here and hiking into Holden Lake. And of course, we knew we were going to be seeing Heart Lake on our way. That was on our agenda. The main reason that we didn't stop and go into, and I think it was the reason we gave them, we had a fire permit that was made out for the whole trip. It had been made out in Bellingham with Mr. Pagter. And we didn't have Heart Lake on our fire permit. And we'd already hiked the 12 miles that day, and we thought if we went on into Holden Lake, most likely we'd want to stay overnight up there. And so we thought, well, we better go on down to the campgrounds and go on up to Heart Lake and stay all night. So it happened that we didn't. We went to Heart Lake all right, but we got there early afternoon, and the flies were bothering us. It was that time of the year. Even 50 years ago, flies were bothering us. And so we continued on up to Lyman Lake that night and found the Lake Chelan Electric Company shelter there, which had a shovel tied to the chimney and a ladder that came down the roof. And this was the very best, most complete, well-equipped looking cabin that we found anywhere in the mountains, because most of them get pretty well overrun with rodents and are not always left in such good shape. But this was in very good shape.
And you had done over 20 miles that day.
Yes, we did about 21 miles, I think, that day.
Besides your trip into the night.
Yes.
But remember, we'd been backpacking for 2 weeks. We were in good shape by then. In fact, over 2 weeks by that time.
How heavy was the pack that you carried?
I think mine was 35 pounds. Our pack's around 35, 37 pounds. The only time we exceeded that was in the Olympics, and we did carry 40 pounds there because we had a longer distance. We had about 8 days between pickups. And here we had a pickup every 6 or 7 days. at Ranger Stations, so.
Did you have any close encounters with the four legged creatures, bears?
Well, we thought it was a privilege when we saw the four legged creatures, except the mice.
You do have a good bear story, though.
Well, the first time we encountered a bear was on our way in from Ruth Creek. And I was in the lead, and here was a little cub running up the trail in front of me. And I, like you people around here, when you hear there's a bear or a baby fawn or something in the village, you rush out there with your cameras. And so I reached for my camera and was starting right up after the little baby, and Dorothy said, "Where's the mother?" And I thought, yes, she's right, so I stopped. I stopped. Well, the little cub looked over its shoulder and it saw us and took off into the brush, and we just stood still and waited till it got out of the way, and then we went on our way. But the story that Dorothy is thinking about is one time when we came around a bend. We had met bear a number of times, and the bear in the national forest were afraid of people.
At that time.
At that time. Now, I don't think that's true anymore, but at that time they just hadn't seen enough people and they got out of the way. They get your smell or anything, they were gone. And so if we met a bear and saw a bear ahead on the trail and it saw us or detected us in any way, it would take off. And we were always disappointed that they would disappear so fast, you know, and we'd never get up close enough to ever take a picture. Well, this time, the bear came around the corner, and again, I was in the lead, and I just kept on walking toward the bear because I was expecting it to get off, and it didn't. And just then, two little cubs rolled around right behind it, and I stopped and waved at Dorothy this way and started walking backwards, and I kept facing the bear to see what she was going to do. Well, the cubs took a look at us and decided that they didn't care about that obstacle, and they took to the brush, and so Mother just turned and followed them, and we just stood there and waited until the bears were gone completely in the brush, and then we continued on, and we hadn't gotten very far before Dorothy slapped me on the back of my back, and she said, "Get going, get going." And I started to run as much as you can with 35 pounds on your back. And I wondered what we were running for. And I ran and I ran and until I was really out of breath. And, you know, on a trail, this isn't very easy. And the bear hadn't caught up with us yet. And I was sure it could have in that length of time. And I thought, why are we running? So I stopped and I turned around and I said, "Why are we running?" And she was swatting yellow jackets. And apparently, I imagine the bears had stirred them up a bit, and then we stirred them up, and I was far enough in the lead, so I only had one on my sock, which was brushed off easily. I don't know if you got stung or not.
Probably. The follower usually does.
So you would understand our being able to do those 21 miles that day if you heard the beginning of this trip, and I don't know if you want to go into that?
Sure.
When we started out, I should go back to Mr. Pachter. He finally, when he saw that we were absolutely sold on this, and he couldn't talk us out of it, he said, "All right, I'll give you," I think he said, 8 days to go through there. "And if you aren't through in that time, I'm sending in a crew with shotguns." And we never have quite figured out what that was for either. We had a ride to Ruth Creek and hiked, I think we camped in Hannigan Pass, and then dropped down to the Chilliwack. There was a trail crew there, and this was a big, very pleasant surprise for us. He hadn't told us that of course, he had issued our fire permits about a week before we left. And so he apparently had authorized a trail crew going in to start on that trail. And they had partially brushed all the way up to, well, pretty well up towards Whatcom Pass on the west side. And this was fairly open and not too bad. The boys gave us a bad time describing the trail and the bridge and whatnot, you know. And we asked about getting across bridge, the Chilliwack first, I guess it was. And they said, well, there's a couple of peeled logs that we put in there, you know, they're
little ones.
Yeah, little ones. And then the other one, they said, we asked about a bridge on Brush Creek, Boz. Well, there was a bridge, but the snow and the high water, it was kind of at the angle of that roof of that building over there, you know. They kept us entertained with this kind of thing. Well, actually, we found that we made our crossings okay. They'd exaggerated quite a bit, although not so much about the nettles and some of the brush that we encountered later. Whatcom Pass was a beautiful, a gorgeous experience, and we were so glad that we had been able to persuade Factor to let us go through there. It's well worth it with the Challenger Peak and the glaciers, and the mountains are really just superb in that area.
I think Whatcom Pass and Cloudy Pass are the two most beautiful passes in the whole Cascades.
I have
the tops.
A third one I add to it.
Maybe I haven't been.
Red Pass.
I've never been.
Oh, yes, you have.
Have I?
Yes, you have.
Oh, coming down.
On Glacier Peak.
Okay, coming down from there.
White Pass and Red Pass.
Okay,
on Glacier Peak.
White Pass.
Dropping into Glacier Basin.
Okay, right.
Those three are just really the most beautiful. Well, things went well into Whatcom Pass, and we spent the night there, and the next morning we started down. And then we began to find out what happens when the trail has not been maintained for a long time, because the switchbacks had sort of slid down into the next layer below, and we were stumbling over rocks and whatnot. We finally got down onto the terminal moraine of the Challenger Glacier, and we're trying to find a trail. We dropped our packs and started scouting in two directions. We always kept the police whistle so we could reach each other. And finally, one of us picked up a trail going into the brush. And you want us to describe the brush. We crawled.
On our hands and knees, dragging our packs part of the time to get through them.
Pushing
through the hole, or pushing and pulling them through, yeah. Nettles also.
Mm-hmm. Yes. In the real brushy areas where there were slides, that was where one of us would crawl through. Just, you would snake through, actually lay down on your stomach and snake through. You know what Mine Maple is like when it's had snow slides, avalanches over it? Then we would push the sacks through, one on the other side finally could pull them through, and then the other one would crawl through, and then we'd flounder around there until we came to another spot like that. And we thought, well, the timber is going to be much better when we get into the woods. And then we found out what he meant by a silver thaw and blowdown. And we couldn't get lost. People asked me, do we carry a compass? You don't need to. If you've got a map, a Forest Service map has the major peaks named in the valleys, and you study your map, and you can kind of sit and line your map up and know the name of the peak up there, and you know you've got to go down Little Beaver Creek. This is it, right down here. You just keep going down. The trail was under, in places, I don't think I'm exaggerating too much when I say 15, 20 feet above ground. Mm-hmm. I remember looking at you sitting up there the time you were crying.
I don't remember that.
I felt terrible because I thought, I got her into this.
And she claimed, she looked around and there I sat on this log with tears running down my dirty face, you know, the streaks down my face.
Well, there was probably good reason for that, because it was getting very hot and sultry, and thunderheads were building up over in the east, and there were rumbles and a bit of lightning in the east, and we began to realize how serious our particular situation was in all this timber. And if there were strikes that were to set something, how many days was it going to take us to get out of there?
We had about 25 miles, I think, to get to the Skagit River.
Yeah, from...
We had to make.
At least that, I would say 35. I think it was around 50 through there and 35.
It may have been 25 a blowdown, but we had...
Oh, yeah, blow, okay, all right.
But we talked about blowdown, it's a logs just down, all directions, and on top of each other. So you'd have two, three logs piled up that you'd have to climb over. We'd walk down one and climb down and then back up onto another log and follow it 20, 30 feet.
Across by what, avalanche?
Wind. A silver thaw and wind.
You know what a silver thaw is when the temperature... One of our naturalists or somebody should be able to explain this.
It's ours.
If the temperature, I forget whether it's dropping or climbing, but it gets to a certain point where there's enough moisture that it ices up solid around everything. Everything is encased in a coating of ice, and it will snap telephone poles, it snaps trees, it just does an awful lot of damage. And we have that occasionally in the Cascade Mountains and on the west side. We might have what they call a silver thaw. Well, that should give me the clue there. A thaw would be the temperature then would be warming up, wouldn't it? And it has been real cold and has warmed up to where you get moisture and then it just freezes around. And then they'd had a heavy wind in addition to that at another time that would continue to slow down, yes?
So what you're saying is that you traveled for a lot of miles without air touching the ground. You were just climbing across the top.
Well, down and back up again. Yeah. No distance of walking. It was just up and down.
Once in a while, we would spot, we'd say, hey, there's a trail down there. underneath us, and we'd say, ah, aren't we smart? We're right on it. But I'll tell you why
we were lucky. We really lucked out. We began to notice new blazes on the trees. You know what blazes are? They used in the old times with a hatchet or an axe, they would cut the bark off and expose the underneath so that it could be seen. And from one blaze, supposedly, you could always see the next one. It might be some distance down the way, but if you stand at one tree that's blazed, you should be able to see the next one. Well, we began to notice these blazes, that we were following these blazes, but we were puzzled because they were so high off the ground. Way up there, taller than a tall man with a long-handled axe would even do it.
And they were new, so they couldn't have had a horse in there, so we figured it had to be done when the
within
snow.
Within the last year, it had to be.
It had to have been done in the winter time when there was a deep snow.
And they were. We met the man who had put them in there later. He had a trap line that he had run, and he knew the country well enough that he was staying that close to the trail, because from the blazes, every now and then we could look down and find the trail and know we were okay.
Who made the trails, and when were they made originally through that part of the country?
The Forest Service.
But when? I don't know.
No, I wouldn't know when that trail was first built. But in those days, there were as good trails as we have now in many places.
But that area, sometime back, had been gold miners had been through there. Hundreds of people way back in, I guess, the 1800s, 1880, 1890. There was no evidence of it, but there had been gold miners through.
Can you give us some more impressions of the valley? Do you remember?
Are you talking about
the valley
we were in, or this valley?
This valley. Yeah.
Or this valley. Well, I remember it pretty much as it is, but without all of the
tailings.
There were no tailings, excepting at the portal. There were tailings there, and tailings above.
And what year was that?
34. Yeah, there were tailings at the portal.
And the switchback for in, do you know when they put in the switchback?
Which switchback?
The one down below.
Are you talking about the road?
The road?
Well, that was in, they had finished it, they had completed, they told us. The road had just been completed that year. And now, I don't know when they started the road, but they said they have now completed the road. And we walked up the switchback. So, yes.
But we can remember, we remember that they were excited about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The road is in. It was an exciting thing that it was. Apparently they had used it, but not, you know, not really finished.
How big was that truck?
Well, I don't know if it was quite as big as your biggest school bus, but it was a, you know, good sized truck.
A 1930s truck.
All right. Well, whatever the size of trucks were, we thought it was a good sized truck at the time when we saw it.
But some of the buildings that when you walk up to Honeyland Heights now, that you see along there, would they have been from that era?
Well, we think so.
The remains of the buildings.
Yeah.
We didn't see them. All we saw was the mine. The
that's
mine
right.
portal
we didn't,
area.
We did not go up to Honeyland Heights. But we're very sure that that's where they were living because the earlier mining had been above that.
Yeah, Holden's first cabin was above 4,000 feet before she put it up around Honeyland.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we had stayed here overnight and had camped, we would have had time to find out and would have explored it, no doubt. And after I came in and discovered what was here now, I regretted that we hadn't done more exploring then.
Well, the thing was, we went through such an experience going through that pass and getting down to the Skagit River, and it took us about 4 days. The best that we could do was going down 6 miles
about
a day.
6 miles.
And then finally we did meet a trail crew. Again, he had surprised us by sending a trail crew in from each end. And when these two fellows saw two women climbing over the logs, and they were delighted. Hooray! Our problems are over. A couple of women can get here,
it can't be that bad. No problem.
We've cut through the worst of it, and we soon disillusioned them. We told them that we asked them how far they were in, and they said 6 miles, and we said, well, you could multiply that a little bit now. Got more coming. When we got out to the Skagit, I called down out to Reflector Bar, which was the ranger station below us, and Mr. Pagder told me that as soon as we got to the Skagit, we were to telephone down and have them put me through to Bellingham. He wanted to talk to us personally, and so I did, but he was below on the Skagit River, and he got right on the line, want to know how things were, and I said, well, you're right, it's pretty much of a mess up there, and if you think those trail crews are going to get that done this year, you better be planning their Thanksgiving dinner. And later, we found out that was just about what happened, too. I mean, they actually, this was late July, you see, when we were coming through there, when the trail crew had started. And even though he sent in reinforcements, we learned from the fellows years later when we hiked through there that they were still brushing and clearing trail in October. So give you an idea of what they had to saw out of logs and trees. The other thing that we ran into there were patches of, Dorothy mentioned Devil's Club. And the Devil's Club in places, you know, we're coming into an area where trees were standing and we could see a part of the trail, you know, and we'd get into the Devil's Club and they'd be over our head. And I don't know how many of you know what Devil's Club are.
No, what is it?
Oh, something we have in Washington that's interesting. It's a rather attractive plant, rather beautiful, and it can grow quite high. It has a very large leaf, but everything about that plant has stickers and spines and spikes on it. The stem, the main stalk, is spiked. It looks like something you might want to grab onto, but don't do it. And even the leaves have little barbs. And they are really barbed like a fish hook. So I know my sister one time out camping got a devil's club barb in, and it infected, you know. So it isn't anything you like to grab onto. It does have beautiful berries at a certain time of the year. It's a pretty plant. But we walked through the forests of devil's clubs and over the trees and whatnot. And then, of course, when we got to the Skagit, it was nothing to us to do 21 miles down that Skagit River to Reflector Bar when we finally went out. But we stayed at the Boundary Guard Station on the Skagit for a couple of days to really clean up and rest and go fishing. And I'll tell a fish story. All I had was a line, string line with a little leader and one hook. And I weighted this down with my police whistle and caught fish. In fact, the water was so clear in the little side streams. We hiked back up to Icicle Creek because that was the fellows that told us that was good fishing up there. And I would have to pull my line out of the water because the fish were so big that we knew we could never eat one of them. And so when we'd see one of these big submarines coming, I'd get my line out of the way and wait. And you didn't. It's a true.
We did eat fish.
And we did selective fishing. We picked the fish that were the size that we could eat, and now that's good conservation. Yes.
I've got a question. I wouldn't ask you how old you were when you did this, but I know, I'm pretty sure I've got four children that are that age or older, and if one of them came to me and said they were going to hike through, yeah, today's time, I wouldn't
let my daughter either.
So what did your parents say when you went to them and said, we're going to take
nothing.
This?
My mother did raise one question. She said, I don't remember how it was worded, but it was sort of, how are you going to find your way through the mountains? And I said, oh, Mom. There are trails and there are signs, just like there are street signs. Well, there were in lots of places. There were in most places. But not where we ended up. I didn't tell her about that.
What other foods did you take with you?
Well, let me read a little bit here on the food. I might read what we took with us. The equipment consisted of sleeping bags, first aid kit, mess kit, flashlights, miner's candles, Kodak films, binoculars, hatchet, hunting knife, fish hook, and line. We each carried a towel, a washcloth, soap, toothbrush, toothpaste, one change of underclothes, extra wool socks, a pair of shorts, and a bandana handkerchief. We wore slacks, a blouse, a sweater, and a windbreak. We discovered that the bandana handkerchief was the most useful article. It was especially useful to me after we'd slid off of all these downed trees and I'd worn out the seat of my pants, and then we met this trail crew. And it also was the cause of our delay down at Reflector Bar because I had to buy new slacks. And the ranger loaned me a pair first there until I could buy some. Our food that we took on this trip, now on other trips we took other things, but this was our first long one together. We decided to use dehydrated foods, and we got most of it at the Hike Shack in Seattle. A careful minimum was planned consisting of dehydrated potatoes, vegetables, soup, onions, milk and eggs. And then we also took a pound of bacon. Yeah, we had that for each week, I think. We always stopped and bought some bacon. And oatmeal, rice, milk, hardtack, Rye Crisp, butter in a tin, and salt, sugar, pancake flour, dried fruit such as pears, apples, raisins, peaches, prunes, tea, coffee, and chocolate. And I have said we divided the food into three portions and mailed them to the ranger station where we would be out. Wrote the ranger and said, we expect to arrive there approximately such and such a date. And would you please also hang on to any mail that comes addressed there, because that's the address we give our family and friends.
We're just about out of time.
Yeah. Okay, are there any last questions?
How many days did it take you?
It took us 19 days. We should have added on. It should have been the full 3 weeks. Should have spent two more days up in this area. And we should have stayed at, if we'd stayed at the camp there near what is the ballpark now, you know, there was a Forest Service camp there, and we could have stayed there. We should have gone on into Holden Lake and then come back down. It wouldn't have been much more than going all the way up to Lyman Lake and stayed there where we did have a fire permit. And then we could have spent another day in Cloudy Pass.
When are you going again?
But we went back. Oh, we promised ourselves we would go back to Cloudy Pass and make it a base camp. We did. But the next time that we came through, we also followed a similar route. We had to go through Whatcom Pass again and go along and pat all those logs, you know, and say, boy, we knew you before you got hacked in two. And from the Skagit at that time, we, instead of going down the Skagit, we cut up Lightning Creek and went up to what is now the Cascade Crest Trail, only it was just on paper then. But the rangers told us, and the guards told us, that if we wanted to follow the Crest Trail route, to just stay on top. And so we did. And we got into a problem a time or two where we stayed on top, and then it was a cliff drop-off, and we had to find our backtrack to find ways around it.
Did you use ropes at all?
No, not on that. I brought this along because I wondered how many of you know what it is, although Dorothy says she saw one in the village the other day. Do you know what this is?
No.
Yeah. Well, this is what you climb major peaks with back in the 30s. It's called an alpenstock. It originated in Switzerland. And has a spike in the tip. And I had one. This is actually Dorothy's. I left mine at the farm, or else I gave it to one of my grandchildren. But we climbed Baker and a few other peaks with this. And that's what they used instead of ice axes. The ice axe was just coming in then. And probably the leader of a climb might have an ice axe. But I'll tell you about one thing. This alpenstock saved my life. One time I was on Mount Shuckson, which I think is a more difficult climb than Mount Baker, and a storm broke when we were up on the peak, a regular blizzard, and we were in fog and freezing rain, and we're trying to get down off the peak, going single file. We were not roped up, but we were staying where we could see each other, and we were crossing a snowfield. And I suddenly there was nothing under my feet. And what had happened was that I had fallen into a little snow crevasse. You know, sometimes the crevasses are big cracks that open up in glaciers. But in the wintertime, they get filled in with snow. And then as the weather moderates, they tend to melt out, but you may not know just exactly where they are. Well, a number of people had crossed this before me, you know, had been trudging on ahead, and had weakened this just enough so that I came along and went through. Well, What I knew was that I was like this. I had not thought about it. It was instinctive. I threw it like this. My feet were just dangling in space. But I had my arm over this alpenstock and my elbow in the snowbank. And there I hung. And I don't think I would have made it with an ice axe. But I was glad I had this. Well, the man behind me, we were told, you know, to stay in view so we could see the person in front. The man behind me saw what happened, and he let a yelp out of him. The fellow in front turned back, and I don't really recall how they got me out by the nape of the neck, but at any rate, they fished me out of there. And so the alpenstock certainly has its good use.
That is time.
It is time now. Okay, that's time for the bell.